Soham, Cambridgeshire, England. A sleepy little town in the country with a tight-knit community. But those community bonds would be stretched to the limit when, in August of 2002, two 10-year-old girls would go missing somewhere in the area. The two girls were at a barbecue hosted by the parents of Holly Wells, one of the girls. At 6:10 p.m., the girls went inside the house to play in Holly's bedroom. This would be the last time any of their friends or family would see them alive. Welcome to the Beyond Evil podcast, where we bring you the most compelling true crime cases from all over the world. Some are disturbing, some are baffling, and others pure evil. We would like to send our sincere condolences to all of the friends and family of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, who were taken cruelly from this world at the ages of 10 years old. The 4th of August 2002 was a blazing hot summer's day in England. Jessica Chapman, a 10-year-old girl who had just returned from a 2-week family vacation in Spain, was going around to her best friend's house for a barbecue. Among the possessions she took with her was a necklace engraved with the letter H. This was a gift that she had brought back for her best friend, Holly Wells. The two girls spent all of their time together, both at school and outside of it. They were inseparable. The girls spent some time playing in the garden in full view of Holly's parents and other friends, including Natalie Parr. After a short time, they went in the house and played computer games. Natalie returned home at around 3 o'clock, leaving Holly and Jessica. The girls changed into matching Manchester United shirts sometime after, one belonging to Holly, the other belonging to her brother, Oliver. Both had the same name on the back, David Beckham, who was a huge star in the world of sport at that time. At 5:04 p.m., the girls asked Holly's mother to take a picture of them both wearing their matching shirts before they sat down to dinner with the other guests. Nobody thought anything of the girls going into the home to play together for a short time, and nobody thought they would leave the house without telling anyone. But having noticed they were being very quiet, Holly's mother went inside to check on them at about 8 o'clock, and to her horror, the girls were gone. After a search by the two families and their friends, the girls were formally reported missing just before 10 p.m. on the 4th of August. Police immediately started searching the area alongside many members of the community who also came out to help find them. An image of the girls wearing their matching shirts was released to the press, hoping this would jog someone's memory. Police searched the girls' school and the local college but found nothing. After a couple of days of intense searching, police asked the parents to take part in a press conference, appealing for anyone who had seen the girls, or possibly had them, to bring them home. Understandably, it was an emotional affair, with both sets of parents visibly shaken. The parents said, "We don't even let them walk down the street on their own. They've always been taught not to talk to strangers. Please, bring them home. If you are a parent, you will understand what we're going through." Given the girls had been taught not to talk to strangers, police immediately suspected they had been approached and possibly kidnapped by someone they may have known or may have had some degree of trust in. This was now the biggest manhunt in UK policing history, and the reward for finding the girls was now at £1 million. Every single sex offender in the area was questioned, and a further 260 offenders from outside the local area were spoken to as well. Even Manchester United themselves helped with an appeal, with David Beckham going in front of the cameras asking them to come home, telling them that they weren't in any trouble. But despite all of these efforts, no breakthrough was made. Police even hired a local drama company to reconstruct the girls' last known movements 7 days after their disappearance. The girls were filmed dressed identically to Holly and Jessica, walking the same streets as they had done on August the 4th. Police hoped this might jog someone's memory, having not realized that they may have seen them just weeks prior. The intense search for the two young girls, Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, had been going on for 13 days. Over 400 police officers from 21 different forces had been assigned to the search operation to help find the girls as soon as possible. The search would end with a tragic discovery on the 17th of August, 2002. A few days before the 17th, Mr. Keith Pryor, a groundskeeper, had been walking through the area going about his day-to-day duties when he noticed a strong, unpleasant odor around the perimeter of the Royal Air Force Base at Wakenheath. Mr. Pryor thought little of it at the time and continued about his business. But as he got home, and for a couple of days later, he just couldn't get the strange odor out of his mind. At around 12:30 p.m. on the 17th of August, Mr. Pryor asked two of his friends, Adam Lawrence and Helen Sawyer, to accompany him back to the area to see if they could discover what was causing the smell. What they would discover would scar them for the rest of their lives. The three of them walked through an overgrown hedgerow with Mr. Lawrence going first. He then suddenly shouts, "Helen, don't come any closer. Get back to the van." Mr. Pryor was following closely behind, and the two men made the horrific discovery. The bodies of Jessica Chapman and Holly Wells had been placed side by side in a shallow irrigation ditch no deeper than 5 feet. The bodies were described as both being in advanced stages of decomposition, added by the fact that the murderer or murderers had attempted to set the bodies on fire, but they had only been partially burned. Hundreds of police officers had spent nearly 2 weeks combing the countryside with no success, but now that was over. An intense and difficult investigation was about to begin. The police weren't given very much to go on at the start of the investigation. They gathered what information they could from the distraught families, but that wasn't of much help either. Holly and Jessica were bright little girls, and it was highly unlikely that they had just decided to run off. They had good family homes, loved, and were cared for in every way. But there was one thing the police had going for them in the hunt for the people responsible. As we mentioned, Holly and Jessica had changed into matching Manchester United shirts. These shirts are bright red and very distinctive, and both had David Beckham's name on the back, something you might notice if you saw two girls walking side by side wearing them. Police immediately launched a public appeal for any information that could help them find the perpetrator. A risky move. The public can, of course, provide useful information, but they can also be an obstacle in some cases. They often receive hundreds, if not thousands, of sightings and other bits of information, much of which is useless. But all it takes is one piece of genuine evidence to crack open a case. This was a small, rural community. People knew and looked after each other. Everyone that the police spoke to said the same things. There was nobody local that they knew of that would harm these little girls, and they couldn't have wandered off and gotten lost. They knew the area well. But the police appeal did start to yield results. Straight away, people reported seeing the girls walking through the town just before they disappeared. A man named Mark Tuck had been driving through the Soham High Street around 6:30 p.m. on the 4th of August. He said that he saw the girls walking through the town, and he knew it was them because of the distinctive shirts they had on. He remembered it clearly because he even remarked to his wife, "Look, there's two little Beckhams." A young woman named Karen Greenwood also reported seeing Holly and Jessica walking arm in arm down College Road just after Mr. Tuck had also seen them. The police also received several separate sightings of a strange white van in the area on the day of the disappearance. Police quickly located the van, which was from the Wentworth area of Cambridgeshire. They seized the vehicle and checked it from top to bottom, but it was quickly ruled out of the investigation. A taxi driver called the police and informed them that he was suspicious of a green four-door saloon car, which had been seen driving down the main road. He claimed to have seen a man driving rashly, thrashing his arms around as he struggled to keep two young girls still in the car while he was driving in the direction of Newmarket. The car was not found, but a jogger in the Newmarket area noticed two freshly disturbed mounds of earth. They immediately called the police, suspecting that the site could be where the girls were buried. Police searched the area, but the mounds of earth turned out to be badger homes. One of the last credible sightings came on August the 5th from a man named Ian Huntley. A 28-year-old man who lived near the girls was also the caretaker at the local high school. Huntley was the partner of Maxine Carr, a teaching assistant who worked at Holly and Jessica's school. She was away at the time visiting family. Huntley said that he was on the doorstep as the girls walked past, and they asked him if Maxine had gotten a permanent teaching assistant job at the school. Huntley said that he told them that she hadn't gotten the job, to which one of the girls replied, "Tell her we're sorry." Then the girls continued walking along the road and down a neighboring street, according to Mr. Huntley. Police went to see him and to take a statement and immediately became suspicious of him. His account did not match the timeline of the other sightings and the CCTV footage taken from the high street. But that did not make him a murderer. Perhaps he simply got confused about when he had seen them, even if he had seen them at all. Regardless, police wanted to make sure that he wasn't involved and sent officers around to search his property later that day. Officers found nothing incriminating inside the home, but they did notice something strange. There had been a lot of wet clothing hanging on the washing line in the garden. It was odd because it had been raining heavily, and honestly, who hangs out there washing during the rain? Also, the house was absolutely immaculate, as if it had been recently cleaned thoroughly. Huntley told police, "Excuse the dining room, we've had a flood." The officers were not convinced by his explanation and Huntley's demeanor, which seemed very abrupt towards them. But the fact remained that no evidence was found to suggest that Ian Huntley had anything to do with the murders, so the officers left him alone. But unbeknownst to him, police had put him on a list of suspects. This was now the only story in the news at the time. The one familiar face that kept popping up in front of the cameras was Ian Huntley. He gave numerous interviews to BBC and the Sky News, appealing for the safe return of Holly and Jessica. The interviews didn't seem to bring anything new to the table, unfortunately. Huntley simply told the media what he had told the police. He had last seen the girls. They were very happy and smiling. There didn't seem to be anything untoward. He declared himself probably the last or one of the last people to have seen them alive. One could accuse Mr. Huntley of attracting the media attention to himself by giving these interviews, but suddenly, he wanted to stay away from the limelight. Media crews were camped outside of his home, following him everywhere and repeatedly asking him for interviews. He stopped talking to the media and even asked all of the footage of him to be kept local and not to be used on nationwide broadcasts. But it was too late for that. His face was now everywhere, and his interviews were being played out over the airwaves repeatedly by every news network. The reconstruction before the bodies had been found had led to thousands of calls coming in to what was normally a quiet rural police station. They were simply overwhelmed and couldn't cope. This is when DCS, or Detective Chief Superintendent Chris Stevenson, was brought in to take over the investigation. He believed his colleagues, although trying very hard to solve the case, were going about it in the wrong way. Strange as it may seem, he immediately scaled back the investigation, disregarding much of the information that was coming from the public. As we mentioned before, public appeals can be more of a hindrance to an investigation of this size, and this is exactly what had happened. Police were receiving reports from all over the country, and that simply wasn't helpful. He began to focus attentions on the routes the girls had walked and on credible sightings from the 4th of August. His attention was to remain purely local. Everything the girls needed was within a few minutes' walk. Their school, play area, leisure center, shops. So it was, in his opinion, highly unlikely they would have gone out of their local area. Each and every sighting from the public and CCTV was examined closely, and it didn't take DCS Stevenson long to notice a pattern. The credible sightings all had the girls local, but what was more is that the girls seemingly disappeared into thin air after walking down College Close and meeting a man outside of his home, Ian Huntley. Not a single CCTV image or sighting was reported after Mr. Huntley said that he had seen the girls. Tracing people's cell phones was relatively new at the time and not something the police had so far considered. But DCS Stevenson discovered that Holly had in fact been carrying a phone with her. He brought in a specialist technician who was able to conclude that Holly's phone had been switched off manually by person or persons unknown. He also managed to detect the last time the phone had pinged off of a mast, giving the police a much smaller area to concentrate on, as this was more than likely the point where they had been abducted. The mast was located just outside of the local college, covering a relatively small surrounding area, including College Close, the street where Ian Huntley lived. Mr. Huntley was already on a list of suspects, as we mentioned, but there wasn't any evidence connecting him with the crime. But given the phone data, DCS Stevenson was now convinced that Huntley either knew more than he was letting on, or, even worse, was involved in the killing of the two girls. He immediately had Huntley put under surveillance and instructed his officers to focus their attentions towards him. They went through every interview he had given since the start of the investigation and noticed that the pressure of the media attention was getting to him. In a short space of time, Mr. Huntley had lost weight and was looking increasingly tired with bags under his eyes. To make matters worse for him, he noticed the increased police presence on his street as they went door to door asking questions. Mr. Huntley came out of his home crying and began shouting at the officers, "Am I a suspect? You think I did it, don't you?" Police also could not rule out Maxine Carr, Huntley's partner, either. She had, of course, been away at the time, but was now gathering media attention herself. She had taken part in the searches for the girls and given numerous interviews herself. Maxine was a particular favorite of the girls at school. She worked with them and taught them, and people described how they adored her. Just like her partner before her, Maxine gave an interview to Jeremy Thompson, a journalist with Sky News. She pulled out a hand-drawn card given to her by Holly, offering her condolences for not getting teaching assistance jobs that she had applied for. Maxine described Holly and Jessica as wonderful girls who were very close to their families. "I will probably carry this card for the rest of my life. This is the kind of girl Holly was. They were both lovely girls." As Maxine walked away, Thompson's producer turned around to him and said, "That was weird, wasn't it?" And Thompson responded, "What was?" The producer, "Didn't she just refer to them in the past tense?" As they rolled the footage back, the producer was correct. Maxine did indeed refer to the girls in the past tense before the bodies had been found. Both Jeremy and the producer described this as chilling. It raised eyebrows, of course, but it still wasn't enough for any formal police action. Then, Ian Huntley did something himself that was considered strange. As the police continued with their door-to-door inquiries, he walked over to one of the police cars and casually asked an officer, "How long does DNA stay around for?" The officer noticed three big scratches on his face, but Huntley said that he got them from playing with his dog. Ian Huntley's inability to stay out of the media spotlight was about to bring even more suspicion down on him. Just like his partner, he was originally from the town of Grimsby. The pair had moved to Soham in 2001 for their jobs at the school. With his face now all over television screens across the UK, people from his hometown recognized him, and many of them started to call the local newspaper, the Grimsby Telegraph, and they had many tales to tell about Ian Huntley's past. It turned out that he had a list of previous offenses, some confirmed, some alleged. These included no fewer than 9 accusations of rape, indecent assault of underage girls, and harming animals. He had previously admitted to having relations with teenage girls, and in the past, one girl, just 11, accused Huntley of assaulting her. He had been investigated 8 times for that type of crime. Unfortunately, none of the allegations had made it to trial, which was one of the reasons why police did not have any record of his previous alleged behavior. The other reasons being that the archaic police systems at the time made it very difficult for different forces to share information. His ex-wife Claire also came forward. She spoke of Ian's threatening behavior and how she lived in fear with him. In 1994, she wanted a divorce, but Huntley would not consent. It took her 5 years to get free of him. In 1998, still legally married, he had groomed a 15-year-old girl named Emma to move into her mother's house with him. Fortunately, thanks to reports from neighbors, social services were made aware. They launched an investigation into Huntley, but it didn't go very far. It was strongly suspected that Emma was persuaded to lie by Huntley to protect him, but unfortunately, they could not prove it at the time. Sometime after that investigation had finished, Emma fell pregnant to Huntley. After escaping the so-called relationship, she spoke of her ordeal, telling of how she had lied to protect him and how guilty she felt about it. She said, "When Ian found out I was pregnant, He threatened to kill me. Not too long after, I suffered a miscarriage. Shortly after, I escaped the home and him. Unsurprisingly, his relationship with Maxine was no better. Neighbors spoke of how they had heard Ian being verbally and physically abusive to Maxine on many occasions. Given these shocking revelations surrounding Huntley's past, the police now acted. They didn't believe they had enough to arrest and hold him. Instead, they asked Ian and Maxine to come into the station and give voluntary interviews. Both interviews went on for approximately 7 hours, and they couldn't have been more different. Maxine was incredibly chatty, stating that she had been with Ian on the day in question and giving a very detailed description of their entire day. When someone is overly chatty like this and answering questions that haven't been asked, it is taken as nervousness and is deeply suspicious. Ian's interview was just the opposite. He was very quiet, not wanting to answer questions and remaining silent for long periods of time. Police finally made the discovery that Maxine, despite her in-depth itinerary of their day together, had in fact been in Grimsby on the 4th of August, rendering her entire interview meaningless. But it did prove two things. Firstly, she was lying. Secondly, most importantly, Ian Hunter now had no alibi. However, the evidence police had built up so far was purely circumstantial, and the couple were released without a charge. DCS Stevenson was still convinced of Huntley's involvement, and he ordered a fresh search of the school that he worked at. This was because he learned that Huntley himself was the person who had shown the police around during the initial search, giving him the opportunity to potentially keep them away from certain areas that he didn't want them searching. During the next extremely thorough search, police finally found some concrete evidence. They searched an area containing large bins filled with bin liners. Upon removing them, they discovered shirts stuffed in the bottom of one of the bins. They had been cut up. They were the charred remains of two Manchester United shirts, identical to the ones worn by Holly and Jessica. As well as the shirts, police found trainers and other items of clothing. When DCS Stevenson received the call from the search team, he broke down and cried on the phone. He later said that he would never forget that phone call and the impact it had on him. Not wanting to wait another second, he immediately had Huntley and Carr arrested for the abduction and murders of Holly and Jessica. Ian used his one phone call to call his mother. He told her he was in the police station on the outskirts of Cambridgeshire. His mother asked him outright, "Did you do it?" To which he replied, "I love you, Mum." Police now conducted a thorough search of Maxine and Ian's home. Without physically finding anything, police still did manage to make a strange discovery. Every single room of the home had been so thoroughly cleaned that there wasn't even a trace of Ian or Maxine's DNA anywhere. Something that's not just strange, it's virtually impossible when you're the only two people who live in the home. Huntley's car was next to be searched. The lining in the boot or trunk had been replaced recently, and the car had 4 brand new tires. When the police tracked down the company who fitted the tires, they explained that Huntley had asked them to be fitted despite there not being anything wrong with the tires he had. Even more suspiciously, he paid the mechanic an extra £10 to put a false registration plate down in their records so no one would know that he had been there. This all took place on the 5th of August, the day after Holly and Jessica had gone missing. Maxine, now realizing how serious the situation was, had a sudden change of heart. She confessed to police that she had been in Grimsby on the 4th of August and not with Ian as she had previously stated. Her excuse for lying was that she wanted to protect Ian and didn't want him wrongly accused because of his past. Huntley, though, was not cooperating with the police at all. He spent his entire interview rocking back and forth in his chair, telling him that he didn't understand the questions he was being asked. Due to his strange behavior, police were forced to send him for a mental health check. Due to the attempt to burn the bodies, it wasn't possible for the pathologist to be 100% accurate as to the cause and time of death. but it was strongly suspected they had died from asphyxiation, and one of the girls most certainly had been the victim of a sexual assault either before or after death. Finally, the test results came back on the football shirts found in the bin. The fibers matched those on Huntley's coat and boots. Police finally had the link they needed between the girls, the clothing, and Ian Huntley. Testing from the road where the bodies had been found also proved to be a match for brick and chalk dust found outside of Huntley's car. The police finally crossed the threshold of evidence needed to charge Carr and Huntley. At approximately 4 a.m., Ian Huntley was charged with 2 counts of murder. Maxine Carr, although not in the area at the time, was still charged with perverting the course of justice and 2 further counts of assisting an offender. At the time, Ian was still being held in a secure hospital where he underwent psychiatric tests. Police didn't believe he was ill, but there was nothing they could do until the judge and the experts made their decision. 50 days later, the psychiatric experts came to a decision. Despite all of his actions to prove that he was not fit to stand trial, the experts agreed, and Huntley was declared fit to stand trial. Both Huntley and Carr entered pleas of not guilty. Their trial commenced in early 2003 in the Old Bailey in London. Huntley had told a strange and not believable story in court. He asked the judge and jury to consider a charge of manslaughter instead. He told the court how he killed the girls by accident. In his version of events, the girls had walked past and one of them had a nosebleed. Having asked him for some help, he took them into the bathroom to clean them up. The bath was allegedly full of water because he had been washing his dog. According to Huntley, he then slipped on the wet floor, accidentally falling into Holly and knocking her into the bath, where she drowned. Again, in Huntley's version of events, Jessica then started crying and screaming. He said he covered her mouth to stop her, but accidentally suffocated her at the same time. The prosecution called his version of events completely ridiculous. Maxine Carr also testified in her own defense, saying that she had only lied about her location because she feared Ian would be targeted for something he didn't do. When asked why she helped him clean up the home so thoroughly, she claimed to suffer from an obsessive-compulsive disorder. Then she claimed that she would try to persuade Ian to go to the police and tell them all about the nosebleed and the bath, but he wouldn't listen. The prosecution described them both as calculated liars. Summing up in court, they said, "We invite you to reject the accounts of both deaths as desperate lies. We suggest this whole business in the house was motivated by something sexual, but whatever he initiated, it plainly went wrong. Therefore, in his ruthless man's mind, both girls had to die in his own selfish self-interests." Maxine was also accused of being just as guilty as Huntley. The defense had little to say when summing up. They simply asked again for the court to return a verdict of manslaughter. In December 2003, the jury finally came back to give their verdicts. Ian Huntley was found guilty of both murders. He was sentenced to 2 life terms and a minimum of 40 years behind bars with, in the judge's words, little hope of ever being released. Maxine Carr got off lightly for her part. She was sentenced to 3.5 years for perverting the course of justice, but was shockingly released just 6 months under a new name. Despite the police catching the killer, questions were raised about their conduct after the trial. The Bouchard inquiry was set up, led by Sir Michael Bouchard, to look at how someone like Huntley was able to get a job in a school given his past. The inquiry found that Huntley had lied about everything when applying for his caretaker job, including his last name. But the school had failed to make any proper checks on his background, something that in the UK, which is called a DBS check, and must be carried out by law before anyone is able to work anywhere near children. Maxine Carr also falsified her qualifications when applying for the teaching assistant job, something else the school failed to check up on. The Bouchard report set out a list of recommendations to change the system and to protect children. A new police database was also set up so that all different police forces around the country could share information on individuals more easily. Huntley was sent to Wakefield Prison in Yorkshire, then to Frankland Prison in County Durham, a prison that is known as being notoriously tough. Since being inside, he has been repeatedly attacked, having boiling water poured over him and having his throat slashed with a razor blade. He attempted to sue the prison service after being attacked in the Wakefield prison, but this came to nothing. He has also taken several overdoses while inside, but to this day remains alive and not eligible for parole until 2042, when he will be 68 years old. Though, as the judge said, it is unlikely he will ever be released. Maybe, in a strange way, we have to thank Huntley for one thing. His own stupidity. Had he not been so quick and enthusiastic about climbing into the media spotlight, he may not have drawn the attention to himself or attracted the attentions of the police. His own perverted, egotistical behavior certainly played a part in his downfall. A mention should also be given to DCS Chris Stevenson. His fresh approach to the investigation certainly played a major role in bringing Huntley and Carr to justice. His emotion upon hearing the news that they had found the evidence showed just how much he cared about finding those who had committed these awful crimes. The police sometimes get a bad name, but it's only right and proper that we recognize an exceptional officer who does so dedicated a job. Ever since Huntley and Carr went to prison, nobody has wanted to buy their home. As the result, it was demolished a few years later and is now just a patch of grass. His parents have repeatedly tried to get him to tell the whole truth about what has happened. He has since told them that the killings were not an accident, but there is still much more that remains unsaid. Huntley's parents said they want to get the whole story so the Wells and Chapman families respectively can have some kind of closure. It isn't known even to this day how Huntley managed to lure the girls into his home. It is assumed that, knowing how much affection they had for Maxine, he may have said that she was inside. But unfortunately, the only three people who know the truth, two of them are tragically dead, and one has never told the complete truth. Maxine Carr's role in these events still divides opinion to this day. Some say that she herself was vulnerable and easy prey for Huntley after the issues she had previously suffered in her life. Others say that she's just as guilty as him for going along with the cover-up of the murders. But Tony Rogers, who was the chief constable at the time, had no doubts, describing Maxine as just as evil and calculated as Huntley himself. She deserves no sympathy. After the bodies of the young girls had been found, in honor of their love of sport, all football matches held a minute's silence before the games began. Chelsea Football Club played Manchester United on that day, with David Beckham scoring a goal. Later, he dedicated that to Holly and Jessica, who had looked up to him so much. Within hours, the local churchyard was full of tributes to the girls. Thousands of bunches of flowers with kind messages covered the grass verges. Two young boys also walked into the churchyard clutching a football. Written upon it were all kinds of messages from local children. The England cricket team also wrote and sent cards to the family offering their condolences. Even Australian Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, sent a card to the family expressing his sadness, demonstrating just how far and wide this case had reached and touched people. The Chapman family have remained quiet and have chosen to stay away from the media since the murders. They still live in Soham to this day and have done their best to rebuild their lives. The Wells family moved out of their home after the death of the girls, but have kept hold of the property and did move back some years later. Holly's dad said that he and his wife nearly divorced because of the pain they went through, but they remain together and are still a very close couple to this day. He said in an interview, "We think about our little girl every day, our little Soham Rose." On the days of both funerals, the church was packed beyond capacity. In a fitting tribute to the everlasting testament of Holly and Jessica's friendship, the two girls were buried side by side, destined to be forever by the other side in death, just as they were in life. As always, here at Beyond Evil, our thoughts are always for the victims first. In this case, two kind, intelligent young girls who had never done any harm to anyone else. They just went out in their local neighborhood where they should have been safe, but found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. We hope and pray that they're now in heaven together, destined to live in eternal peace as best friends forever. Rest in peace, Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. If you found this story compelling, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen and leave a 5-star review if you would like to show your support. Also, don't forget to hit that notification bell to stay up to date each time we reveal a new, shocking case. Until next time, stay safe and keep your eyes peeled. You never know what's lurking in the shadows.